Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Mormon Church's long tradition of globe-trotting evangelism is changing with the times. Missionaries still go door-to-door, but church leaders also have begun sending them through the ether of the internet. Joining us now is the Huffington Post tech editor who wrote about this trend recently, Bianca Bosker. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So the Mormons actually had a ban on social media use. Was it just for their missionaries or for everybody?
Just for their missionaries. Okay. So, up until this past June, so last summer, the Mormon Church prohibited their missionaries, who are generally kind of 18 to 20-something years old, so active social media users, from using any sort of Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, during their missions. So they could go online once a week just to write home or write a blog about their experience, and they could only call home twice a year, I believe, but there was absolutely no social media.
Okay, so what changed their minds?
So the church announced this past June that they would begin allowing all 80,000 of their missionaries to start using the internet in their proselyting efforts. And what changed, actually, there was a small mission that actually a lot of people don't know about, based out of Provo, Utah, that started off as a way of accommodating injured and disabled missionaries, and as a sort of PR projects the church. So they would have them log on, and they would take chats from anonymous people online and answer basic questions about the church. And the church thought this was sort of a nice way of answering questions about Mormonism, but nothing would really come of it. Wrong. What ended up happening is that these online-only missionaries, so they were working, just on the internet, using Facebook, using these chat services that the Mormon church set up, were actually converting and retaining more members than any mission in the world. I mean, just multiple times the average number of missionaries that someone would convert. And so their success here, I think, illustrated for the church the potential to use the internet in bringing new people to the religion. So in a sense, we're now seeing the Mormon church do for religion what Amazon did for stuff. They're using the web to make shopping for a new faith convenient, easy, and accessible 24/7.
Do we have any sense about the demographics of who they're attracting by way of the internet?
That's a great question. So there's not exact data on that. Anecdotally, a lot of the missionaries that I spoke with who are serving on these online-only missions speak a lot with, younger people, people that are teenagers, high schoolers, 20-somethings, a very web-savvy audience that's very comfortable with communicating online. The other fascinating thing is that these online-only missionaries are able to access people that normal missionaries, traditional missionaries, would never have been able to reach. People inside gated communities. They're able to even reach potential converts in countries where the church is not officially recognized. So they've been bringing people to the church from places all across Asia, and also just reaching everywhere from Ghana, Albania, France, you name it. So they're really not confined by any sort of geographies or fences, for that matter.
First of all, you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Bianca Bosker, Huffington Post tech editor, and we're talking about how the Mormon Church has adjusted to the times and now evangelizes by way of the internet. If you have a question or comment, you're welcome to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. Has this changed the rate of their door-to-door operations around the world?
So it's too early to tell yet. So basically, this online-only mission, which is in Provo, Utah, something that started in 2008, and again, it initially was kind of a minor effort, and it turned out to be this accidental success. So The average missionary will convert about 6 people during their 18 to 24-month service. These online-only missionaries were converting about 30 people a year each. So that's huge, huge change. And at this point, it's too early to tell whether this new hybrid combination of using a little bit of the internet in combination with going door-to-door will sort of continue to grow those numbers and the rate of baptism. But they're certainly optimistic. I mean, there's a sense of, the church actually talked about this. One of the elders in the Mormon church who announced this huge change last summer basically said you know, people are not comfortable bringing strangers into their homes anymore. People are now interacting with each other mostly online. That's where people are comfortable, discovering new information, communicating with strangers. And so the Mormon Church is basically adapting to our new mode of communication that's been brought about thanks to technology.
So do they have to wear a black tie and a white shirt when they're doing this?
They do. You're right. So Mormon missionaries do have a uniform that they have to stick by. You're right. For men, it's a suit and tie, basically. And even the ones operating online, they also have to wear the suit and tie, even though their potential converts don't see them.
And it's still just in the Provo operation.
This idea of online-only missionaries, I believe actually, so they now have people, the way it works basically is there's something called Mormon.org, which was set up as a sort of public-facing home of the Mormon Church. So for people that are not Mormons to come and learn about it. Mm-hmm. And on that, you will find a small tab that says Chat with a Mormon, and anyone can instantly connect with a missionary, and they don't have to give anything more than their name. It's very anonymous. And now they actually have missionaries taking those chats not only in Provo, but all over the world.
I was going to say.
Multiple different time zones.
Yeah, can't they be in their mom's basement in their pajamas doing this?
They could be, but they're not.
Okay.
So they now have centers, I believe, in New Zealand and Mexico. They have people in the UK taking chats. So again, anytime the urge strikes to indulge a little bit of curiosity about the Mormon faith, they are now there, ready, waiting, and able to take all comers and answer questions. So it's very powerful because this has really reversed the whole way that the church does its missionary work.
Mm-hmm.
So it used to be that the church would go door to door trying to convert people. Now people are coming and knocking on the church's door.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is it actually lets missionaries use their time much more efficiently. Instead of talking to, a lot of people and a lot of deaf ears, they can just focus on the people with even a little bit of an interest, a tiny bit of curiosity. And they can take that seed and they can plant in their mind an idea about converting and joining the church.
Has the church, the church used to ban social media for the missionaries. Have they had any problems with this newfound access to the internet?
So it's a great question. The church is being, in some senses, very careful about it. So missionaries, you might know, work in pairs, mm-hmm. known as companionships. And so when the missionaries are working online, they're sitting side by side with their companion, and they're both monitoring each other's screens. So they're watching what they're doing, they're keeping an eye on it, and that's the sort of peer pressure chaperoning process, if you will, that helps them stay on task. I think that there's not, there are small peccadilloes where people do mess up. So, for example, in one of the pilot missions that was trying out this combination of offline and online missionary work, there was an anecdote I heard about some of the young men were using Facebook not to discuss the scripture, but to flirt with some of the girls that they'd met on their rounds. And that is not permitted. And they did lose their access to Facebook. But generally, I hear that they are, good about respecting the rules. The Provo, Utah Center, where missionaries are taking these chats, also has their employees actually reviewing the chat logs. So they basically do quality control on the missionaries' conversations with strangers to make sure that they're staying on message, they're sharing the right information, and things aren't devolving in any way. They do have an issue with trolls, however.
Okay.
As you can imagine, any sort of place on the internet where you can do something anonymously and mess with real people will be messed with. And so there's a lot of kind of Bart Simpson characters that are definitely logging on to chat with the Mormon just to mess around with these missionaries and waste their time.
So are they trained to deal with that?
They are, and they're taught to be, they're taught to see, I think the expression is every troll has a soul, something like that. And, they are respectful, they are polite, they won't have them waste their time, but they make it clear that when they're ready to have a serious conversation, the trolls can come back. In fact, one of the people I profile in my story is a young man who around 15 or 16 discovered Chat with a Mormon, had no idea who Mormons were, thought it was another word for Amish, and he went online with chat with a Mormon just to mess around with them. I mean, totally waste their time. And he actually ended up being converted. He's going to be leaving on his mission sometime this spring, I believe.
What is this a desirable post? How do they get their missions in the first place? And are they applying for this? Is this a desirable post, I guess, as a mission?
So you aren't really able to choose where you go as a missionary. There's, you know, as far as applying, I mean, there's really a kind of expectation that young men will go and sort of serve on a mission, you know, when they're young. It's kind of a rite of passage.
But women know.
Women also. I mean, also it's encouraged, but I think it's not as much of a expectation. I mean, there are many, many women now. I think there's been an uptick in the number of young women serving on their missions, but it's not as much of a requirement. I don't want to say it's a requirement, mm-hmm. But there's a real sense of responsibility among young men that this is something that they must do.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sort of send out to say that they're interested, they're ready to be called, and the church assigns them to where they go. The Provo, Utah mission, where it has online-only missionaries, is something that has, again, you know, has generally been for injured and disabled missionaries who would have difficulty with the door-to-door walking of a traditional mission. And so, again, the church determines where they go. But I spoke with one missionary who served there who, you know, this has not exactly been a secretive mission, but one that hasn't necessarily gotten a ton of press in the past. And when he served on his mission a few years ago, he had no idea what he was in for. He thought he was going for a call center, and he was just devastated. And he was absolutely delighted when he realized that using the internet, he would actually be touching and speaking with more potential converts than any of his other friends, really. I mean, we're talking about thousands of people that sign up for these chats every single day.
So has this influenced, or is there anything like it that parallels this activity going on in other churches?
So the Mormon Church, contrary to...
I should say other faiths or whatever.
Yeah, so contrary to its conservative reputation, has actually been a real early adopter when it comes to technology. So throughout its history, they've been very, very eager about trying out newfangled inventions, be it, you know, movies or the, you know, kind of mass printing presses, to really get their word out. And this has proved no exception. You actually see the evangelical faith also being very active about not only sharing the faith, but really trying to give people an easy into the faith online as well. So we're not at the point where people are getting baptized over the internet.
What do you know?
There's no telling what will happen. But if you look at like Joel Osteen's Lakewood Church, for example, or I believe it's called U Church. There's another evangelical church that holds online services. It has online churches for people to go to and worship together online. And so those have been very, very active. There's even prayer walls that function almost like the social media site Reddit, where you can literally click pray to pray for someone. So there are ways that I think, you know, churches and different faiths have been very, very active about figuring out how you use social media to get your word out, and it has proven to be an incredibly effective medium.
Bianca Bosker, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bianca Bosker, she's the Huffington Post tech editor. Gee, you can get baptized over the internet, but do we have jetpacks yet? No. Coming up, we're going to hear about what sort of technological future Americans think is ahead. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Meet George Jetson.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. That, of course, is the theme from the 1960s cartoon The Jetsons. The show depicted a utopian future with flying cars that can fold into suitcases and sassy robot maids. Those were some high expectations. Turns out that Americans remain fairly optimistic about technology. That is, if technology you think is a positive thing, I suppose. The Pew Research Center's Internet Project recently published a survey of what Americans expect from the future in terms of innovation. And joining us now by phone to discuss the results is senior researcher Aaron Smith. Welcome back, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
A question for listeners, if you want, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Tell us what your expectations are for technology in the next 50 years, 614-292-8513. Aaron, why is the opinion of Americans about our technological future of interest?
Just to give a little background on this study, we actually did this in partnership with Smithsonian Magazine. And so their May issue is devoted to looking at the interplay between science fiction themes throughout the years and modern developments in real-world science. So they're looking at the science angle. And so what we wanted to do as part of that was to get a sense about where the public stands on some of these futuristic issues. So where do they see the science heading in the next 50 years? And how do they feel about some of the developments that might be arriving on the near-term horizon?
And you all characterize Americans as being largely optimistic about technology, meaning it's going to be a good thing for us.
Yeah, so there was an interesting sort of break there. So in the long run, when you ask people whether they think that scientific and technological developments will have a positive impact on society, about 6 in 10 Americans have an optimistic view. So they think that those changes will make life better in the future than it is today. At the same time, though, when you ask them about some short-term developments, so things that maybe are a little bit controversial, that might upend some of our social norms around things like privacy or surveillance or the nature of social relationships, they have some concerns about that. So what we're seeing is sort of realism that we might have some challenges getting to that good future, even as people think that overall we're going to wind up in a better place than we are today.
One technology that people seemed most positive about was medical technology, in particular transplants with organs grown in a lab. They obviously haven't seen the movie The Island. Were they generally positive about health science?
So we asked a series of questions about, you know, sort of what people think will happen. So is it likely that certain developments will actually become reality? And by far, the one that they thought was most likely was this notion that people needing organ transplants in the future will have, you know, custom organs grown for them in a lab somewhere. And we've in fact, a week or so ago, some scientists did a transplant of nose cartilage for people with nose cancer that were grown in a lab. So obviously we're already taking steps in that direction, albeit in a sort of a very simple sense. But people very much thought that was likely to happen. They were also relatively convinced that computers in the future would have the ability to create pieces of art, so novels or movies or music, that is on par with what humans are able to create. So that was our effort to get at this notion of, you know, artificial intelligence and the sort of continued advance of computers in that regard. At the same time, they were pretty varying degrees of pessimistic as to whether we'll achieve some other sort of common science fiction themes. So a minority thought that we would, for instance, solve the problem of teleportation and space colonies, although actually the least likely prediction that they thought was likely to happen was that humans will be able to control the weather. So just 1 in 5 Americans think that weather control is going to be a reality. They were actually twice as likely to think that we'll be able to solve the issue of teleportation, which was sort of interesting to us.
Were there any surprises to you?
So that was certainly
one,
the one that jumped out to us.
And when we say teleportation, we mean like the de-atomization, like
exactly.
A la,
so trans, trans, Exactly. The Star Trek, future of, you know, beaming people up and down to various places. we found that really interesting that just given our knowledge of the science, that people thought that that was more realistic than controlling the weather. And so there's obviously something about people's perceptions of, you know, of Mother Nature as this entity that's sort of going to stay outside the control of humans for the foreseeable future. We were also a little bit surprised at how many people expect computers to really, you know, match humans on some very human-like attributes. We expected that number to be a little lower. So
you mean like the writing and that's,
exactly,
and so
yeah,
forth.
That's, you know, that's sort of the greatest test for artificial intelligence is, you know, can they carry on, you know, emotional conversations and be creative in the way that humans are able to be. So the fact that about half the public thinks that's likely in the next 50 years, you know, could obviously have some profound implications for people like you and me who do creative things for a living.
I'm a huge fan of science fiction, and I wondered if you checked for that as far as the responses, whether the people, how people responded, and whether or not they were influenced at all by science fiction, or even, you know, what I grew up with, you know, as a kid, you know, the 21st century with Walter Cronkite.
Yeah, so we didn't ask that specific question, partly because it was a little bit hard to, you know, so many things involve science fiction themes these days that
yeah.
It was a little bit hard to even come up with a consistent definition internally of what we meant by science fiction. What we did ask is we gave people the opportunity to sort of tell us in their own words if they could have one futuristic invention, what would that be? And we were really struck by how many people, you know, really pulled themes from, you know, the classic science fiction that we all sort of know and love. So,
like what?
The number one thing that people mentioned was, you know, people really are interested in being able to get around the world quickly, easily, or more adventurously than they are today. So we had a lot of people telling us things like they want a flying car, they want a personal spacecraft, a jetpack, a self-driving car. and the other thing that really came up, in addition to a number of people mentioned, you know, that they wanted to have better health or, you know, cures for major diseases, was time travel. So again, another very classic kind of science fiction theme. So what we really saw is that lots of people, and particularly young people, wanted to be able to explore not only their own world, but the world of the future or the world of the past in a way that they're not able to do today. So we really saw people kind of jumping to some of those classic science fiction tropes when we asked them to tell us in their own words what they would like to have if they could have it.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Aaron Smith. He's a senior researcher of the Pew Research Center's Internet Project. We're talking about Americans' opinions about what's to come in future technology. If you have a question or comment for Aaron, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Was there any thread of dystopia in the responses? There's so much of the science fiction, so much of particularly young adult literature is dystopic.
Right, and we did sort of see that, and it was interesting that despite the fact, you know, in the long term, you know, if you tell people to think about what life is going to be like in 50 years, they tend to be fairly positive, and they tend to, you know, to see a lot of really cool things coming down the pike. The sort of dystopic or kind of concerning aspect of things comes into play when you press them on some inventions that might be happening in the shorter run. So we asked people about things like, expanded use of personal drones over U.S. airspace, or designer babies and robot caregivers. And when you ask people about a lot of those things that are a little bit controversial, obviously in the case of drones, or that, you know, kind of challenge a lot of our existing social norms, that's where you start to see people get a little bit uncomfortable. So even though they see this good future, when you ask them about some of those sort of near-term inventions, they tend to think that that would actually be a bad development if there were, you know, widespread personal drones put into use, or if robot caregivers became the primary caregivers for elderly or people in bad health. So what you're really seeing is that, you know, things that could impact their lives in the near future, people are a little bit nervous about that, particularly for things that again, are controversial or sort of challenge those existing social norms. So that's where we really saw that dystopian notion come into play in the responses that we got.
And things that change us as humans, for instance, implants or devices that could be that put into us?
Absolutely. So the third thing that we wanted to do is we wanted to get a sense of how interested people were, not necessarily whether they thought it would be a good or a bad thing, but whether they themselves would be interested in trying certain inventions that we think might be common in the relatively near future. And so when we asked people about those, the most people were most receptive to this notion of driverless cars. So about half the folks we talked with said that they would in fact like to ride in a driverless car, which depending on your view may seem high or low. I think given the love that Americans have with car culture, I think that's actually a fairly large number of people who would be willing to give up their autonomy behind the wheel. But when we asked about issues like getting a brain implant to improve your memory or your mental capacity, not too many folks were interested in doing that, and very few of them, just 1 in 5, expressed interest in eating meat that's grown in a lab. So clearly, people are willing to take a wait and see approach on some of these new technologies that we might be seeing coming down the future in the near term.
You mentioned that they remained skeptical about things like space colonies. The idea of space exploration is not necessarily something people are as positive about now. 50 years ago, it would have been the exact opposite.
Right, and it was interesting. So when we asked that question about whether people think that will happen, about a third of them say that they expect long-term colonization of space. But there was a really interesting age break there. So younger people, so particularly folks, in their 20s, were much more likely to say that they think that's going to happen compared with older folks. And when you think about it, that kind of makes sense. People, if you're 60, 70, 80 years old, you've been hearing about our future in space for really your entire life, and clearly it hasn't come to fruition yet, and in fact we've shut down our manned space program. So the older folks were actually much more pessimistic that is going to become a reality, having been hearing about this all their lives and not seeing much movement in that regard. Whereas the younger generations were much more likely to think that is likely to happen. So we saw an interesting age break on that question in particular.
And the issue of parents controlling the DNA or the gender is not that big of a deal, but the DNA, the more we know, that was people were conflicted about that as well.
Yeah, they were. So we asked whether it would be a good or a bad thing if prospective parents could alter the DNA of their children to produce smarter, healthier, or more athletic offspring. So not necessarily, looking for a particular gender or a particular hair color, but really trying to sort of create a child that has a better chance of succeeding in life. And about two-thirds of Americans think that it would, in fact, be a bad thing if that were to take place. Interestingly, there was an interesting sort of class difference there. So folks in sort of the lower end of the income scale, so people who have not been as successful economically or financially in the existing economy were actually more likely to say that would be a good thing. So and we saw that kind of general trend throughout a lot of this, where people who had the winners of today, the people who have sort of achieved the most success from existing technologies, were sort of most positive about the future of those technologies, whereas people who may have had their job displaced by a robot, or who haven't had as much success from today's technologies, were more pessimistic and more receptive to things that might sort of help their offspring have a better life in the future.
That's an interesting have and have not distinction. Were there others that you saw?
Yeah, that was really so there were some modest age differences. That was a really big the sort of the class distinction there, or the sort of today's winners losers distinction was a really big one that came through. The other one that was sort of interesting was there were some interesting gender differences on this, and so by and large, men and women were mostly about the same, but when you sort of looked at certain issues, so for example, I hate to play into stereotypes here, but men were much more likely to say that they'd like to try meat that was grown in a lab. So I think, you know, again, that sort of feeds into that notion of men being able or being willing to eat anything.
Right.
And women were much less receptive towards the notion that, people in the future might be wearing implants or other devices that sort of feed them digital information about the world around them. So men were very positive about that notion. Women, by about a 2-to-1 margin, said that they really would not want to live in a world where those sorts of devices were commonplace. So that was very interesting as well.
And going back to the robots caring for us, not just children, you're talking about robots caring for elderly as well, lifelike robots.
Yeah, and that was... that was another one where about two-thirds of the folks we spoke with said that it would be not a good thing if robots became the primary caregivers for elderly folks. And what was really fascinating about this is that it didn't really matter on that question whether you were young or old. I think we anticipated that older, people who were in maybe their 50s, 60s, 70s, who could potentially, be the guinea pigs for developments in this area, might be more nervous about that. And what we found was that it didn't really matter whether you were, young or middle-aged or older. People, by and large, were sort of equally negative about this notion. And so, again, it gets back to this idea that, that concept really changes our notions of, what younger generations owe to older generations. And I think, consistently across the board, we found that the people were really nervous about sort of changing that norm in a way that is really sort of, a big paradigm shift from what we currently have.
Yeah, those of us who are aging are wondering, are the younger people going to step up to the plate? Because
I think the younger folks were, envisioning their future and wondering if that's really how they wanted things to play out as well.
All right, Aaron Smith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, and always a pleasure.
Aaron Smith, he's a senior researcher at the Pew Research Center's Internet Project. Coming up, Russell Holly from Geek.com. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. There's some good news for Android users this week, especially for the photo buffs who rely on their phones for their pics. The Google Photosphere camera app is now available for most Android phones. Joining us to talk about that and much, much more is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks.
So why is Google Photosphere, and say that 5 times in a row fast, so great, and why has it only been available on certain devices until now?
So Photospheres are a technology that Google worked with for a little while and then released on their Nexus 4 phone last year. And it is a really neat technology that takes the idea of a panorama photo and stretches it into a 360-degree ball all the way around you. So you can effectively take, instead of just a straight line of photos, you can take a sphere of pictures, and then with your phone you can either share it online or view it with your phone. You can see just the entire space that you're standing in and share that experience with others.
How does it do that?
Well, it very much in the same way that a panorama works. It's all about taking all of those images and stitching them together. And the cool thing about all of the smartphones that we have now is that there's gyroscopes and accelerometers and things like that in the phone so that the phone itself can be sort of spatially aware and can use that to make the stitching more accurate.
How does it compare to other camera apps? Is there anything else like it out there?
Well, so after the Nexus 4 was released, HTC and Samsung and LG and Nokia all released very similar applications that offered kind of the same set of features, but not every single feature. And so what Google did this past week was released a separate camera app so that even though you already have a camera app on your phone, you can install this app on your Android phone and gain access to all of the features that Google has implemented that were originally only for their Nexus phones.
My guest is Russell Holley from Geek.com. If you have a question on technology for Russell, on anything, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or if you have a question about Google Camera or the Google Photosphere, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what improvements does the new version have in general, or is it just that there's more access to it?
Well, so more access is definitely a big deal,
sure,
especially if you've got the new HTC One or a Samsung Galaxy S5. But the really big deal here is kind of like better stitching, but also the ability to take much larger photos.
Hmm.
There was a limit on how big Photospheres could be before, because when you share them to the web browser has to handle this kind of massive image, and then the code along with it to allow it to rotate around and show you everything that is in this sphere around you. But Google has figured out how to take that and make it so that you can take up to 50 megapixel images in this sphere technology all the way around you. So you get way larger photospheres that can be kind of zoomed in on, and you can really get a more immersive experience out of it.
And why was it released to the Google Play Store instead of just making it an update?
Well, the whole idea is making it so that every Android phone can access it instead of just something that only is available to the Nexus phones. Google wants to kind of level the playing field when it comes to all of the different phones that are out there running Android so that it feels like a more kind of standalone, ubiquitous experience.
Okay. Jake in Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Holley. Hi, Jake.
Hey.
Got a question.
So I was wondering if you have considered the implications of this technology with devices such as the Oculus, which is coming fairly soon. I'm kind of imagining in this future state world where I can put on a headset and someone can send me an experience that they've recorded with their 360-degree camera. And I can, hike down into the Grand someone in VR.
I mean, that's an incredibly powerful idea, and it's actually something that Google worked with Nintendo to accomplish on the map application that's on the Nintendo Wii U, where you can actually hold up the Wii U gamepad controller and do exactly that. They have this kind of 3D tour through Tokyo and South America and a couple of different places where you kind of hold the screen up in front of you, and when you turn your body, the person is turning their head. Applying that to something like the Oculus Rift would really just be software. I mean, all of the hard work has already been done. So absolutely, I would say that something like that is possible in the very near future.
All right, Jake, get to work. Thanks for that call. Let's move to Nokia's mobile division. It's being renamed Microsoft Mobile. That rolls off the tongue easily. But it doesn't mean that the names on the products will change. What's going on?
So we knew that Microsoft and Nokia were becoming one company, and there was a lot of questions about where the people in charge of certain parts of Nokia were going to go and how exactly things were going to fit together, mainly because there was a lot of speculation for a while that Microsoft was going to start making their own smartphones, their own branded phones, kind of like they did with the Surface tablet.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not that's still happening is kind of a thing that's been set aside, because Nokia is going to be the hardware arm for Windows Phone 8 and for their own, Microsoft mobile platform. And it's going to be an interesting thing to see how it happens, because Microsoft already has hardware partners like Samsung and HTC,
mm-hmm,
who have been making Windows phones. And now, now Microsoft has their own internal hardware group. So Microsoft is kind of competing against their own partners right now.
How long does the whole process, they've begun the process of changing the name. How long is it going to take, and what does it mean?
The big thing is really reaching out to distributors and sales groups and things like that and making sure that there's no confusion when it comes to paying the bill. You know, there's a lot of people who are used to doing business with Nokia, and if that switch happens overnight, then it really just ends up being a paperwork thing.
Mm-hmm.
So by the end of the year, I would expect that Nokia would be phased out entirely, and we would see maybe one or two Nokia phones still on shelves, but by that point having a wave of Microsoft mobile phones coming out with that branding.
How is Microsoft's hardware partners reacting to this?
So far, there hasn't been any negative responses that are public, but it's kind of hard to imagine so early on that there would be. HTC and Samsung have both kind of had really tepid responses to Windows phones so far. And while a lot of improvements happened with Windows Phone 8.1, it really wouldn't surprise me if we don't see more than, you know, one phone from each one of them this year, and then have them seriously reconsider whether to do it again.
And what would be the disadvantage, if any, of abandoning the widely recognized, often mispronounced Nokia name by me? What would be, is there a disadvantage to any of this?
Nokia has a really strong reputation. I mean, there's a long ongoing internet joke about how Nokia phones are indestructible and how you can, you know, take them and do anything with them, and you know, they're going to continue to keep on going. Mm. And that, you know, that reputation would certainly be less clear when Microsoft Mobile replaces the Nokia branding. But, you know, they're still keeping a lot of those hardware teams. And even today, Nokia's Windows phones are incredibly durable and very well made. So I think that there's going to be some brand confusion initially, but I'm not sure that it's going to end up being a huge deal.
Okay, we have an email from Tom. He says, does Russell have any insight on the issue with Apple's new operating system for iPhones, iOS 7, causing iPhone 4Ss to lose Wi-Fi? Oh, is that the problem? Apple denied the issue for a long time and finally issued a statement. Large numbers of iPhone 4 users lost Wi-Fi, and many petition sites demanding action were launched. The new OS caused the phone to run hotter, burning out the Wi-Fi chip. Apple denied that they created the problem and refused to fix phones.
Yeah, so there have been independent hardware studies that are separate from you know, what Apple did there, and nothing has been able to confirm that the Wi-Fi radios are actually being damaged. It's a software issue. They are definitely a lot of cases where it's running warmer, but no, I don't have any further insight on that. I mean, as long as there's no conclusive evidence that this is definitely something that's happening as a result of the software, then I can't imagine Apple doing anything.
Email from Susan. She says, I am interested in purchasing a tablet and not an Apple product. It would be my first one. Can you talk about the positives and negatives of the Samsung Tab 3 and the Microsoft Surface 2 or other non-Apple tablet that you like?
I think that Samsung's Tab 3 is a great kind of budget entry to market for Android tablets. I would also recommend the LG Nexus 7 if you're looking at Android. Microsoft has a really neat concept with the Surface 2. The design is really nice. The ability to strap a keyboard onto the bottom of it ends up being more commonly used than I originally thought, especially if my kids decide to pick it up and use it. Mm. But there's not nearly as many apps available for the Surface 2 as there would be for the Samsung or the LG. So if you're planning on using it mostly to surf the web and goof around, then I would say probably look at an Android tablet. But if you're looking for something that you might maybe consider using as a laptop replacement, then the Surface might be more your direction.
Okay, you wanted to talk about the Oculus Rift Tron light cycle. It's a street-legal Tron light cycle that Parker Brothers has made. Tell us about this.
No, so this was it was something that I referenced in that article. They have made, there's a company that has made two street legal light cycles that are from the movie Tron that you can purchase for just extraordinary heaps of money and ride around. But they're really bulky and I wouldn't recommend it. But there is a virtual reality simulator that is using a headset called the Oculus Rift that almost like an arcade game lets you sit on a fake light cycle and using this helmet that consumes your entire field of vision and all of your audio really gives you this incredibly immersive experience. And that's one of the cool things about the Oculus Rift, is that it's going to be this technology that you can have in your home that's relatively inexpensive that can create those experiences.
What are there other types of video games that they've made like this?
Absolutely. The Oculus Rift is still kind of in development. It's something that probably won't be a finished product for a little while.
Uh-huh.
But there have been huge developer support for first-person shooters and really just a ton of different computer games. And it's gained so much popularity that Sony has a competing product that they've announced for release later this year. So it definitely looks really weird. And I say that as someone who wears Google Glass, but it's kind of weird to wear these big plastic headsets on your head. They are definitely bulky and kind of odd looking, but it is hard to argue with the just incredible experience that you feel when you put one of these on and go to play a game. It really feels like you are there.
Hey, speaking of Google Glass, they were throwing them out, you know, they were opening them up to the public. Do you know how many takers there were?
They have not released numbers. There are a lot of people trying to find that out. I know that there was one point where the white version of them had sold out entirely, but we still don't know exactly what that means.
And is anybody talking about their new experiences with them, newbies?
They would start showing up sometime this week.
Okay.
So I haven't seen one yet, but it's definitely something that I'm going to be paying closer attention to.
Okay. Stephen and Powell, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Sorry I'm going to be circling back to something you guys spoke
okay.
about just a little bit ago, but one question I think hasn't been addressed is, you know, why did Microsoft acquire Nokia? You know, they did have hardware providers that were taking care of their phones and stuff. But I think I've got the answer, and I just want to share, and I'll just, let you resume the conversation when I jump offline. But my feeling is that the big three, being Google, Apple, and Android, know that they can control the app stores much with a tighter rein by owning their own devices. Being a small software company, we've seen basically the revocation of the open web taken away from us by these walled gardens, if you will, meaning anything that gets sold through these platforms, whether it be an iPhone, an Android device, or a Windows device, 30% off, or 30% is taken right off the bat. And then you, of course, have your bandwidth fees on top of that. And forever, people have been worried about the way the internet's been going, where they're starting to throttle and giving preferred access to other companies and faster bandwidth to certain companies, those who pay the premium. Now there's a further encroachment, it seems to be, where these companies want to own their own hardware, so that way the third-party developers that fuel these app stores are now basically at the whim of these big three. So anyway, I just want to throw that out there see what you guys' take was going to be on that.
All right, Stephen, thank you so much for the call.
Mm-hmm.
Russell, what do you think?
I think that Microsoft owning their hardware aspect gives them a baseline to encourage other hardware manufacturers to follow suit with, kind of in the same way that Google did with the Nexus program, although theirs is more partner-oriented instead of building the devices themselves. But it's certainly something to be aware of that, you know, when you are dealing with a company that controls every single aspect of the pipeline, that whatever they say goes, and as long as you're in their sandbox, you don't really have a choice. And that's something that, you know, kind of from a tinkering standpoint for me personally has always kind of kept Android's appeal for me. But it would be difficult to say that is absolutely going to happen, but it has certainly happened in the past.
All right. Well, Russell Holly, once again, time flies. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
It's Russell Holly. He's a tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.